Two and a Half Admins, episode 245. I'm Joe.
I'm Jim.
And I'm Alan.
And here we are again. And before we get started, your customary article plug, Alan, is Inside FreeBSD NetGraph, Behind the Curtain of Advanced Networking.
Yeah, so this is a kind of a dive into NetGraph, which is a kind of user-space composable networking framework on FreeBSD. So NetGraph's been around for a long time. It was especially popular back in the old like PPPoE DSL days, but it provides this ability to have a bunch of kind of transforms of the network stack. If you're familiar with Geom for the storage stack, where you can have a bunch of layers where you can transform stuff and like add RAID and things like that, it does the same thing for networking. So it allows you to have composable blocks that the network goes through, and it can each block can change stuff. And it's a really interesting way to be able to build advanced networks out of basically user space code without needing to do more advanced stuff in the kernel. It's really interesting. We also have an article, if you dig to our website, on using NetGraph with Beehive for virtualization to be able to create more complex networks to interconnect bunches of VMs in different ways and so on. It's very interesting. It's worth checking out.
Right, well, link in the show notes as usual. Some crosswalks in Seattle got hacked, and it turns out that it's probably because they were using the default access pin of 1234.
Now, the amusing thing here is that when we say the crosswalks are being hacked, we're not at least currently talking about anything amazingly nefarious. The crosswalks are still working. The impact of the hacks has been that they've replaced the standard, you know, soothing robot voice, walk, walk, with AI, you know, speaking in the voice of Musk or Trump or Bezos, you know, saying horribly insulting things about those folks. And I can't personally say I hate that too much. I think it's funny that the reaction of some of the cities impacted by this has been to disable their crosswalks entirely to avoid, you know, playing the audio clips that make the billionaires sound bad. That doesn't seem like a safety-focused initiative to me. But I think the real thing here that's worth drawing people's attention to is still, in this day and age, you know, publicly deployed infrastructure that millions of people touch is being secured, you know, with like a pin of 1234. It's like a Spaceballs skit, man. Like, yeah, that's the combination of my luggage.
For clarity, if people aren't American or whatever, at the zebra crossings to cross the street in many places in America, there's a little beg button you have to push to ask permission to cross the street. And then eventually a light turns and it's your turn to go. And for people with disabilities, those things have an audio alert so that, for example, someone who is blind can be told when the light has changed the right color and they are allowed to cross the street. And it normally says walk, or it says wait, 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 walk. And yes, in this case, it turns out that you can reprogram these officially using an app that's available in either the Android or iPhone app store.
Or was available.
It's real hard to find that APK now.
Yes, true.
But the point being that a four-digit pin was never strong enough in the first place. The NIST standard for security has been not to have the same default password on every manufactured product for quite a few years now. You know, almost every device is finally getting to the point now where they don't come with the default password of admin password or admin admin and a pin of 1234 and so on. But this is basically the same level of security as if, you know, that big box at the side of the traffic stop that actually controls how long the green light is and how long the yellow light is. If they left that unlocked and people could just go up and twist the knobs and make the red light only 1 second and the green light 2 hours, and they just left that unlocked, why these can be programmed by just walking up to them and not having, you know, to physically connect to it, something that could actually be kind of vandal proof, that required a physical connection to it or something. I don't see how they would need to change the voice programming on the beg to cross the street button so frequently that it makes sense to have it have Bluetooth or whatever in the first place. But this is just really bad design from the manufacturer, even worse security posture from the city deploying it, and as Jim said, an even worse response to the problem of just, well, screw the disabled people instead of fixing the problem.
Polaris statement to the Register in the Register's coverage of this was also pretty illuminating in my personal opinion. And I quote, "We believe unauthorized individuals may have gained access to the products using valid credentials. Side note, remember, that's 1234. Importantly, there is no indication that Polaris network has been compromised or that there is any exploited software vulnerability in the product. Well, no, because it is a vulnerability. You designed it to be vulnerable. And I think the one last thing that I want to say to this, you know, onto Alan's point about why was this designed this way? What's up with these pens? Like, even if it wasn't 1234, a four-digit numeric pen isn't even vaguely enough security. All these things. What this really points to is, and this is something I keep thinking ought to be getting better, but it doesn't seem to. There's an idea among non-technical people that like, oh, well, I don't need to actually worry about securing this technical thing because like, that's just nerd stuff. Like it's only nerds that could do that. Like normal people would never, whatever. So just having to be a turbo nerd is already enough of a deterrent. And that was sort of something that kind of made sense if you were really short-sighted in like 1989. But in 2025, everything is technical. Everybody has to be vaguely technically competent just to get through their day. It's like securing something by assuming nobody can figure out how to saw a wooden dowel into. Like, dude, secret's out on that. Like, it's real easy. You can go to Lowe's and buy a saw and you're good to go. And that's where we're at now with these ideas like, oh, well, you know, you have to have the app from the app store. And if you weren't somebody who did this stuff, like you wouldn't know the app was in the app store. So that's enough. 1234. Good enough.
Yeah. Security by obscurity. But really, I think we're just lucky at this point that someone wasn't malicious with this. If they just switched the recording, so instead of saying wait, it said walk. And instead of saying walk, it said wait. Then some person with a visual impairment runs out into traffic because the crosswalk told them to, or is standing there waiting to cross the road while it's supposed to be, and the people in the car are honking at them and causing. It's like you literally could have got someone killed. Why is there not some culpability for this? We've gotten to the point now with you buy a router and there's a unique password per device on the bottom on a sticker. Like, how do we end up with deploying crosswalks with a default password of 1234?
Even Google struggles to balance fast but pricey flash and cheap but slow hard disks, according to the Register.
This is interesting to me, and I wanted to cover it because everybody always thinks, man, I have the best idea, tiered storage. I have a fast SSD, but it's kind of small, and I've got a slow hard drive, but it's big. And anytime I save data, it goes to the solid state drive first and gets copied out to the slow hard drive later. And if I read it a lot, it can stay on the SSD. That's going to be amazing. Now I have huge, but fast and cheap. And unfortunately, it's just not that simple. Tiered storage can be effective at the large enterprise scale. But basically, the reason it can be effective there is because you can end up in a situation where you have so much resources that you don't have enough competent storage admins to really directly administer the whole thing quickly enough to keep up with changing business needs. So it may make sense to turn everything over to a big dumb algorithm that can work with thousands of fast drives and slow drives and just kind of glom it all together. But is it ever going to be able to keep up with intelligently directly managed separate pools of slow and fast storage? No, it will not. So to the vast majority of our listeners, probably 5/9 worth of our listeners, tiered storage is not a great answer for you. If you have storage needs that are in some cases like I need a lot of IOPS, it needs to be as fast as possible, really low latency, tons of throughput, doesn't have to be a whole lot of data. Well, that goes on solid state drives. You should probably have an all flash pool for that. Whether we're talking ZFS or some other storage technology, just using pool in the more generic sense. But yeah, have an all flash pool for your all flash needs. And if you do need to store a whole lot of data where there's more bulk to it than there is like IOPS needs, Rust is still king for that, and you can absolutely build yourself a Rust pool. It might make sense to add a little bit of flash in ways to accelerate your Rust pool and kind of saw off the worst of its performance problems. But, you know, in this concept of just a, quote, simple, unquote, tiered storage where, like, everything automatically winds up on flash if it ought to be on flash and winds up on Rust if it doesn't need to be on Rust and you don't have to manage it, sorry, that's just really not a thing.
Really, it comes down to, in order to recognize the patterns that humans tend to imagine are there, like, you know, the human brain really tries hard to pick patterns out of randomness. And so it often thinks it's seeing a pattern when it isn't, right? Like people seem to say, oh, if I flipped heads five times in a row, the chances of me doing it an extra time are really, really low. And it's actually, no, it's still the exact same chance it was the first so many times.
Yeah. Or how many faces have you seen in inanimate objects?
Yeah. And, you know, people seeing all kinds of things in clouds and so on.
Whereas the real question, if you flipped heads five times in a row, should not be, oh man, how much can I possibly bet on it being tails next time? Your real question ought to be, is this coin rigged? Is it going to come up heads every time? The answer is still probably no, but you should be much more worried that perhaps the coin is you know, a fake than you should be just convinced that next time it's going to even things out for you.
The pattern is usually not as there as the human brain tries to make you think it is. And so while the computer can look at all the accesses and maybe decide, okay, this bit is actually being accessed enough, we should move it. Many times these systems end up just shuffling data back and forth and actually costing you performance because they're busying up the hard drive, moving a bunch of data to it to then wait a minute and move that or different data back to the flash and using up a bunch of the bandwidth just shuffling things back and forth. Even ZFS has the problem. The L2 arc is not very smart. And most of the time, it's a last ditch thing. And it doesn't usually end up helping you that much. So Google's built theirs. They called it L4. I'll explain a little bit more about that in a second. But basically, it's a giant separate metadata server that sits to the side of their file system and looks at the accesses. And you basically send it a request. And it's like, oh, do I have a copy of that on the SSDs? If yes, I will give you the copy from the SSDs. If not, I will tell you to go to the hard drives. And I'll consider maybe moving that block from the hard drives to the SSDs if I get a couple more requests for it or something. That's very basic, least recently used cache that your kernel does on your file system in your computer every day. It's not some brilliantly intelligent algorithm that definitely knows what you're going to read next. It's just looking at, oh, if you've read this 10 times today, you're probably going to read it again tomorrow. Why don't I keep it on the fast storage? And then very quickly realizes, well, the stuff you really use, you use 100 times a day. But you don't completely fill the SSDs with stuff you use 100 times a day. So I'm going to keep churning all the stuff you use 10 times a day back and forth and back and forth. Because it turns out, oh, you use this one 10 times in the morning and then never for the rest of the day. And this other one you use 10 times at night, but never for the rest of the day. And it just keeps ping-ponging and so on. It gets very complicated.
This also presumes that you've got a considerable amount of downtime where you don't need all your IOPS because you're going to be consuming those IOPS every time you move something back and forth. So if you're thinking something along the lines of the old SSHDs, you know, from a while back, the one-piece devices that were a tiny solid-state drive built on top of a Rust hard drive and the whole thing was supposed to, you know, work without direct human administration, you may have noticed they don't sell those anymore, and they don't sell those anymore because they never worked worth a damn. And the reason they don't work worth a damn is they are too small and too simple. And if you think that, oh, I can just move stuff back and forth whenever I need to, as I need to, well, now you're talking about, again, consuming those IOPS you don't have enough of in the first place and frequently doing it for no good reason at all. Where this can make sense is, you know, like what Google is doing, where I hope you were noticing when Alan was talking about how many times we did something with this data today and maybe changing where it lives so that tomorrow will be better. Like, that's kind of the way you need to be thinking about it. You can't afford to just say, well, somebody read this right now, so I need to move it to the flash right now instead of having it on the Rust right now. Because if you're reacting that rapidly to accesses as they happen, you're going to chew through more IOPS than you save.
How much space are you going to spend keeping the table of which thing's been accessed how many times? And if something's only accessed 10 times a day at Google scale, you don't want to be spending any memory on it at all. And it's like only the things accessed a million times a day are going to be in this table. But what happens to the thing that's accessed 900,000 times a day? It keeps kind of blipping in and out of the table. And how much money do we spend on just the size of that table? And so on. And even Google admits their thing doesn't work that well. They're manually moving data back and forth, but oftentimes they have to give it a hint. So as part of the path name, when they save a file, they can say, hey, this needs to always be on the SSD. Or this, we shard the data across like four different like nodes within the system. make sure at least one of the copies is on SSD for now. So when I originally wrote it, at least one of them is on the SSD. So there's a fast way to access it. But if something fails, we can fall back to the hard drives and we'll not have lost the data.
In other words, for the most part, even Google is doing what I opened up this segment saying that you should be doing, which is you just have a flash pool and a Rust pool, and you as the human decide which things should go where.
Yeah, they're kind of doing it by slightly mixing the two together, but there is still this separate agent. And basically, the whole flash thing is actually more of a cache layer than an actual storage layer. And so, yeah, it is all kinds of crazy. But back to the why they called it L4 is basically because they're treating it as a fourth level cache. Your computer does this exact same thing all the time, thousands or millions of times a second. On your CPU, there is a data cache and an instruction cache. On most modern things like my Ryzen 7 or my home server Epic 9124, that cache is 32 kilobytes for data and 32 kilobytes for instructions. So whenever you're doing something with some data, the data you're using the most is sitting in that 32 kilobytes that each of your cores in your CPU has. And that's it. That cache is really, 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 really fast, but there's only that much of it. And then you have an L2 cache, which in my case, my Ryzen has like half a megabyte per core, whereas the Epic has like 1 megabyte per core. And then there's an L3 cache, which is, you know, 32 or 64 megabytes. And some Epics, I think, go up to like a gigabyte of that. And then you have things like your NVMe and so on. And it all comes back to this idea of a memory hierarchy, which is actually described by von Neumann in like 1946. So we've been trying to figure out how to tier data access from the fact that you have a tier and it's fast, but it's really small. And we have a next tier and it's bigger, but slower. And another tier, even bigger, but slower, all the way up. And we've been trying to solve this problem since 1946, and we don't have the answer. But basically, these same decisions about what to cache and what to keep are being made by your CPU millions of times a second, and it's getting it wrong a lot of the time. It's caching something it didn't need to cache, or throwing something out of the cache it would have been better to keep. And because that cache is only 32 kilobytes, you can imagine when you're dealing with gigabytes per second of data, how many times you're creating and destroying items in that cache. Or even if it's the 4 megs of L2 or the 32 megs of L3 that you have, how many times are you making the wrong decision on that cache? And how much work do programmers spend trying to align things so they fit in the same cache line and so on, because it makes such a big difference, but you're still going to fail like 90 some odd percent of the time.
And how much of the write endurance of that flash are you wasting on all those mistakes that you made dumping garbage into the cache that you're just going to evict right afterward because it never should have been in there to begin with? This is what, again, it's we keep coming back to the same thing. Like, this stuff is interesting, but until further notice, if you're a person who is looking for advice from a podcast about tiered storage, the advice that we have for you is it's snake oil at this point. You can do better managing it yourself, we promise.
Okay, this episode is sponsored by people who support us with PayPal and Patreon. Go to 2.5admins.com/support for details of how you can support us too. Patreon supporters have the option to listen to episodes without ads like this. And it's not just this show. There's Late Night Linux for news, discoveries, audience input, and misanthropy. Linux Matters for upbeat family-friendly adventures. Linux After Dark for silly challenges and philosophical debates. Linux Dev Time about developing with and for Linux, Hybrid Cloud Show for everything public and private cloud, and Ask the Hosts for off-topic questions from you. You can even get some episodes a bit early. We've got a lot going on, and it's only possible because of the people who support us. So if you like what we do and can afford it, it would be great if you could support us too at 2.5admins.com/support. The web is broken, in my humble opinion, writes Jan Wildeboer.
So this is basically building on what we talked about the other week, where the AI scrapers were using people's private home IP addresses in order to get around easily being blocked. And we asked the question, how are they getting access to this? Are they just paying off people at the ISP or what? And so Jan managed to do some digging, and he found kind of a new class of botnet that's basically built out of these what he's calling network sharing SDKs that some apps are being built with. And so it'll be some kind of app, whether it's actually malware or it's disguised as a video game or something. It has this SDK built into it so that when people are running the app, they're also basically running a proxy that allows these bots to bounce traffic through their phone or device and get access to their basically the normal home traffic IP addresses. And I think the worst part of this is, in addition to using up your personal IP and possibly resulting in you getting a lot more captchas when you're trying to browse the internet because you have one of these things pinging stuff off your device, is probably also running down your battery if it's a portable device.
Yeah, and you don't know what these things are going to be used for. It's very concerning the way that these things are just getting shoehorned into other apps where you don't necessarily know it's there. We already know that a disturbing number of people are perfectly willing to entirely knowingly let companies or random people use their internet addresses for things, because there have been several schemes for that over the decades, and people will generally flock to them. If they think it gets them access to something for free or a lower cost, they'll frequently say, sure, I don't care if my internet connection gets a little slower. But it's not only about your internet connection getting slower because somebody else is using it. It's not only in this day and age of potentially blowing through, you know, your data cap on mobile devices, which is where most of this is going to be coming from. It's also about what is being done in your name. The AI data scraping is bad enough, but you don't know that that's the only thing. You don't know how much actual ransomware distribution might be going out from your IP address. You don't know that somebody that's going to, you know, want to be downloading child porn isn't diverting some of that through one of these services. I am not directly accusing any of these services in participating in child porn distribution. Please don't get me wrong. But these are always your concerns when you allow some unknown third party to proxy its traffic through your IP address. You become the one who has effectively signed off on that traffic because it exited from a node that you are paying for. It is your name and your address that is tied to that activity. This is one of the concerns that means, you know, you probably don't, if you were just some random, normal, everyday person, you probably don't want to be running a Tor exit node, because again, there's a lot of nasty stuff that goes over Tor, and anything that exits Tor coming from your house, you're going to be the first person that law enforcement is looking at if that turns out to be really nasty. So in this case, probably the AI data scraping is the worst thing, but I mean, man, that's bad enough. I don't want to go too deep into this because we just covered how sketchy this AI data scraping is. But remember, again, we are talking about companies that are perfectly willing to, for no conceivable benefit to themselves, just out of laziness or apathy or God knows what, they'll scrape the same recent changes list multiple times a second, 24/7, 365, for months on end on small sites with camouflaged IP addresses and camouflaged user agent strings. It's war, man. Do you really want that going out with your name and address tied to it?
Well, it could also be used by like denial of service as a service things, you know, script kiddies that will pay to DDoS a game server. Well, they can use these things too. But the analysis Jan has here, they found it being used to try to brute force Bitwarden, which is a password manager, scraping house prices and stuff, but creating new accounts at live.com and Instagram and mail.ru. I wonder why you would use someone else's IP address to create an email address. Oh, right, to send spam. All of this stuff is just contributing to the worst parts of the internet and breaking everything. And the worst part is, it turns out a lot of places are apps being convinced to add this to make money instead of ads or in addition to ads, or worse, malicious people taking existing free or shareware applications and bundling this SDK into them and competing with the real software with this other version that is just making them money by selling access to your device.
On desktop, by the way, one of the more frequent places where you might wind up with one of these proxy services, you know, kind of riding hitchhiker on into your system, browser extensions are one of the most common places this gets shoehorned into. You see a lot of people that installed some fun little browser extension. I don't know, maybe they wanted to change the word cloud to the word but, you know, you name it, just little frippery, silly stuff. And you think, oh, well, that's fun. Well, yeah, that's fun, but there may be more to it than just the fun. And this is one of the things that tends to ride it. You also need to be really wary about downloading shareware-style distributed software from legacy distribution hubs, you know, like SourceForge. The K-Lite codec pack is another one of the places that we've seen a lot of the Infatica in particular has gotten bundled with the K-Lite codec pack. And now, does that necessarily happen all the way at the source? Like, you know, the people who actually distribute the K-Lite codec pack themselves? Not necessarily, but because it is freely distributed, you find it showing up at all kinds of distribution sites, at SourceForge, at Major Geeks, at, you know, this, that, the other. And any one of these places can decide to use an installer for this thing, and the installer also puts in unrelated third-party services. That's the way the SourceForge downloader worked for years. I'm not sure if it's still that way or not. Some, at the very least, less shady people got control of SourceForge about, I think, like 10 years or so ago, and said they were going to bring it back and make it better. And they at least seemed to be for the first couple of years. But, you know, it's kind of one of those things where it had gotten so bad that it kind of almost doesn't matter who gets it now. I'm never going to trust that brand again.
Yeah, but like, even if you Google and try to download regular open source software, like VLC, the video player or something, half the time you will see sponsored ads going to not the official site to give you a version of the downloader with shit like this bundled into it. And I think some of it is also up, you know, at the feet of the advertising networks for allowing these fake things or people to buy advertisements for something that's not their product and sell basically the malware-laden version of it. And I think Google and some of the other ad networks need to take some responsibility for disseminating some of this stuff. But it turns out this is probably where the majority of this is coming from. And like the article says, Infantica is claiming they can give you 15 million unique IP addresses for $29.
Bargain. Let's do some free consulting then. But first, just a quick thank you to everyone who supports us with PayPal and Patreon. We really do appreciate that. And if you want to send in your questions for Jim and Alan or your feedback, you can email show@2.5admins.com. Don writes, I have a system with two matched 8 terabyte disks, which I foolishly built as a non-rated, non-mirrored, non-ZFS. I have data on one of the drives, but too much to move off somewhere, but I still want ZFS mirrors. My question is, can I create a ZFS mirror with one disk, then copy the data to it, and then add the second disk as a mirrored pair, or am I going to need to get another disk into the system somehow?
You do not need a third drive. This is as simple as it could possibly be. You build a single drive pool with the one drive that you still have free. You copy all your data to it, and then you just do a Z pool attach, to attach the first drive that you have now gotten all your data off of to the one that you built a single drive pool out of, and that turns it into a mirror VDEV. So you don't have to do something special to create, you know, a single disk mirror or like a faulted mirror or whatever. You just create a single drive pool. That's it. And then later you can attach the missing disk and you're good to go.
Yeah, I've done this plenty of times, even a slightly more complicated version where we had a bunch of servers installed out in other countries that were TrueDrive UFS mirrors. And I wanted to switch them to ZFS, but I'm not in Germany. And so this involved literally taking the second drive out of the mirror of UFS, reformatting it ZFS, rebooting onto it, then deleting the other UFS drive and adding it back to the now ZFS mirror and letting it resolver and having, you know, basically remotely swapping a machine from a mirror of UFS to a mirror of ZFS without any console access and the servers in a foreign country. It's easy to do with something like IPMI, but those old Hetzner boxes didn't have that. So this was all seat of the pants and hope it works. And if it doesn't, the rescue system you have is Linux and it doesn't know what the hell you're talking about.
I definitely did that quite a few times back in the day, breaking up Linux kernel RAID and reassembling the drives into ZFS. And yeah, all this stuff is easy, it's reliable, and it has been for well over a decade. So you're good to go.
Yeah, and that, like Jim said, the really nice thing about ZFS there is it doesn't have to know it's going to be a mirror. You can just create a pool with one disk. And so if you, you know, if a different listener has a pool with one disk and wishes they had made it a mirror, all you have to do that is zpool attach, pool name, old disk, new disk. And it's like, huzzah, it's now a mirror.
Yeah. And then just wait for it to resolver.
Yep. And it will copy all the data from the first drive to the second drive and then be done. And you'll notice compared to something like MD, ADM, or even the Gmir on FreeBSD, it doesn't have to copy every single byte of the partition over to the other drive. It's ZFS, so it knows which data is there and what is empty, and it only copies the data.
Right, well, we better get out of here then. Remember, show@2.5admins.com if you want to send in your questions or your feedback. You can find me at joerest.com/mastodon.
You can find me at mercenarysysadmin.com.
And I'm at Alan Jude.
We'll see you next week.